I'm David Martin Davies, and coming up on The Source, rock and roll coming out of New York City in the first years of this century was essentially lame. At least that was the conventional wisdom of music critics and record industry officials until The Strokes. The Strokes jump-started a new age of heavy beat power chord rock out of the Big Apple and breathed new life into the local music scene. Other bands, Interpol, Yeah Yeah Yeahs, Vampire Weekend, TV on the Radio, and others were now also in the spotlight. But simultaneously, this was during the death of the old record industry, along with the demise of enjoyable commercial music radio stations, and the birth of internet music, blogging, and fan empowerment. Lizzie Goodman writes about the reshaping of the New York City music world in Meet Me in the Bathroom, Rebirth and Rock and Roll in New York City, 2001 to 2011. That's what's coming up on The Source, but first, this news. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, 89.1 FM. I'm David Martin Davies, and this is The Strokes and their 2003 song, Meet Me in the Bathroom. Lizzie Goodman is a journalist who writes about rock, fashion, pop culture, and has authored the book, Meet Me in the Bathroom, Rebirth and Rock and Roll in New York City, 2001 to 2011. Goodman says her book is titled after The Strokes' song for good reason.
Without The Strokes, a lot of these other artists would not have gotten noticed or gotten, or the industry would not have come around to noticing them. The band looked amazing. They had these amazing songs. The record was incredible. They were a gang. There was just a sort of like a sense of wholeness about what they had. But it was also things beyond their control. It was the complete disinterest in rock and roll cool at that time within the industry, and then the utter shift of that as launched by them, especially in the context of like post-Napster, post-9/11 New York City.
So the Strokes' 2001 debut album, Is This It?, helped usher in this garage rock revival movement, it's been said, and Rolling Stones calls it one of the best debut albums of all time. What's a good cut to play from that album right now?
Hard to explain is one of my favorites. That's my go-to when I'm returning to that era of them.
Strokes before they were The Strokes. I mean, you were with them when they were still trying to figure out which way to point the amp.
Totally. Yeah, that's funny. Probably even literally. Yeah, I mean, it's a totally random. One of the things that I love about oral history and why I wanted to do it this way was that I know personally how many kind of intersecting stories are playing out, not behind the scenes, but sort of concurrently with the rock star lives that we all read about in music magazines, such as they exist anymore. You know, like that, there's all this other stuff going on. There's people's lives that are happening as well. And I know that because I had that experience. I mean, I was in love with New York City. I'm from New Mexico. I grew up, you know, Southwestern girl, kind of enamored of big city life. And I moved to Philadelphia to go to college. And then I started coming up to New York from Philly for summer jobs. And my first summer job, the summer I turned 19, was working in a restaurant with these city kids who are kind of, you know, fellow like hustlers for the summer trying to make some money. And one of them was Nick Valenti, the guitarist in the Strokes, one of the guitarists in the Strokes. So my first introduction to the Strokes was my friend Nick's band. And it was like Nick and I were about the same age, but he had just graduated from high school and was kind of, you know, like loafing around New York, like smoking weed on corners and trying to just do as little work as possible and get paid and practice with his friends. And that was kind of my intro to both like peer rock band life. Like, I didn't know any kids in bands in high school, so it's sort of like, oh yeah, my friend's band, will go to his show, that whole world that I didn't even know existed. And then also, you know, this was the Strokes, so it's the kind of one in a million chance that band in my life would turn out to be A, good at all, and B, like, you know, culture changing. But that's what happened.
And here's another cut from that album, New York City Cops by the Strokes. City, it's a big part of your book. That's what makes your book interesting to me, because I really, this is not my music. It's not my era, but it's interesting because I'm learning so much about a part of New York City, which is a cultural capital. And this is the scene at the time. And New York is New York.
So nice to hear you say that. And thank you, because I really, you know, I think it's an important point. Like, I keep saying, and I realize it sounds a bit like a line, but this is not, I did not write this book exclusively for fans of the Strokes or LCD Sound System or Vampire Weekend. Like, this is a story New York in which New York is the primary character, and New York City as an idea, as much as a place, is this kind of primary American export, you know, this notion of freedom, of cool, of possibility, of reinvention, like all that stuff is on the continuum of what New York represents. And musicians have often been a part of that, from, you know, like Miles Davis to Dylan to Madonna and to the punk scene that the Strokes and their like kind of were compared to, Patti Smith, Television, all that stuff, Blondie, and then to this world as well. Those are all like sort of stopping points on this larger trajectory about the story of New York. But I really think it's the story of New York is kind of in part the story of America, or can be seen that way. And certainly a lot of the ideals that we promote, that we think of as part of our identity as a nation culturally, are oriented around this, you know, this metropolis, this Gotham idea.
And here is NYC by Interpol.
They are
seems like, you know, a lot of the bands were self-aware that this was New York and that they were writing about New York and being at a time of special vulnerability in New York City, in a time of transition in New York City, and that comes through their music. Lizzie Goodman, is that, do you see that?
I think the vulnerability piece is really on point, but it doesn't come necessarily from the things we think it comes from, because we know, as sort of as outside observers of this era, 2001 to 2011 is loosely the period covered by the book. I mean, it starts a bit earlier than that. But if you're Interpol and you're writing a song like NYC, or you're Yeah Yeah Yeahs and you're writing the Fever to Tell album, or you're the Strokes and you're writing New York City Cops, like, all those songs, for the most part, were written, or most of those songs were written before 9/11, before, like, there was this sort of incubation period of nothingness. Nobody cared about New York City bands. It was not cool to be in a New York City band. There's this great line by the esteemed Jenny Ellisview in the book where she's sort of talking about, like, how if a band rolled through New York, seeing shows in New York, you wanted to see bands from out of town. If a band from New York was playing, you'd be like, oh, they're from here? All right, well, I guess we can go check it out. But it was not a cool thing to be. So I think the vulnerability piece, though it, again, through the synergy of timing, got synced up really, really, I mean, deeply, unfortunately, but also resonantly with this, you know, attack on our country, on our city. The vulnerability began for those bands generally from a place of insularity, of feeling like they had the freedom to say and do and be and feel however they wanted to be, because nobody was listening and nobody probably ever would. So then in this new New York that they were sort of surprisingly thrust into the limelight of and called upon to represent, it was like, well, those songs are from a different era. They're from a place of almost intimacy and quiet and lack of spotlight that certainly didn't last for very long once the gun went off with the Strokes and everybody else.
Let's go to break with New York, New York by Ryan Adams. So we're talking with Lizzie Goodman. Her book is Meet Me in the Bathroom, Rebirth and Rock and Roll in New York City, 2001 to 2011. Back after this.
Well, I shuffled through the city on a 4th of July. Had a firecracker waiting to blow. Breaking like a rapper who was making his way to the cities of Mexico. Lived in an apartment out on Avenue A. Had a tall on a corner of town. Had myself a lover who was finer than gold. But I've been broken, I've been busted up since. Love don't play any games with me anymore like she did before. It's our time, sweet babe, to break on through. It's the year to be hated, so glad that we made it. 'Cause all the kids in the street whisper sounds that sweet. The stars under their feet. Well, it's the year to be hated.
That's Our Time by the Yeah Yeah Yeahs. This is a track that about the New York City during a special time. Things were happening at the turn of the century. This is from the book Meet Me in the Bathroom, Rebirth and Rock and Roll, New York City, 2001 to 2011. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. The author is Lizzie Goodman. Our Time, what was special about this particular time then?
God, I love that song so much. Yeah Yeah Yeahs are, to me, the kind of the center sound of a lot of this for me. That's where I go when I'm trying to remember why it was so awesome. I think the magic of the era was connected in some ways. It's a universal feeling. It's like the title of the introduction that I wrote is Youth and Abandon. And as a kid going to shows during that time, that's how it felt. I mean, before these people became famous, it was like you knew all these kids in bands, and their bands were the soundtrack of your life. And you went out every night you could and saw as many shows as you possibly could. And everything that was happening to you, from, you know, your whatever you were doing in school or work to whoever you were dating to your friendship ups and downs, like all of it was kind of interconnected with the sound of these artists. And I think in that sense, this is a universal feeling, because all young people who love music are finding their own soundtrack to that particular era. So what was special was partially just that that soundtrack for me and my immediate friends became global.
This is The Kids Don't Stand a Chance from Vampire Weekend. These things conspiring to a changing age. We're moving from analog to digital. We have the corporate death of commercial radio, and we have the internet, where people can pick music from across the world, and you can distribute your own material, yet no one knows how to do that yet. You have all these dorky MySpace pages, but everyone is afraid to give away their music because they're still hooked on that model that you're going to make your living off of selling CDs through a giant record label. And this is a time when all that is dying. So it's a transitional period. Transitions are always tough, but transitions also bring opportunity.
Yeah, I think that you set the scene very well. And it's MySpace, it's all of that. Everything you just said is totally accurate for like the first 5 years of the book. But when the Interpol, Strokes, LCD Sound System all exist in an essentially pre-internet world. I mean, Napster exists, but there's no way to even host music online yet. So, I mean, that's not until a few years into the early 2000s. So A&R executives are still signing bands the old-fashioned way. They have to go see them play live. You can't email an MP3. That'll, like, crash your computer. I mean, there's still the technological revolution is coming, but there's a lag. So it's easy to – anyway, this is all to say – I was going to say it's easy to sit in your corporate desk and pretend that everything's fine. Like, it wasn't banging down the door every day. It was a slow but fast process at the same time, the utter unraveling of the music industry. But I think the connection to that and why rock and roll wasn't cool was there was this sense of, hey, it's not going to be the same old thing, right? Like, you're not leather jacket cool, please. Like, New York City, oh my God, please. Like, the only thing cool that had happened in New York City, the last cool rock thing was Seattle. And the takeaway from that was that you don't need a big city, that you need, you know, a group of friends, like-minded friends in any town America. That's the idea. In fact, this kind of urban notion of like bars and style and fashion and tight pants and anything like that was considered really like gauche, basically.
The idea was that if you were from one of these cities, Seattle or Austin, that somehow there was an authenticity to your point of view, which was of interest to other people.
Right. And so we're talking about a great era of American indie rock and the indie corporate divide is still, you know, alive and well. And New York City is just like, why bother, for all the reasons you just said. And then also hip hop. I mean, New York City was, that's what was, had last been cool in New York. I mean, it's the Beastie Boys, it's Jay-Z, it's like Biggie. This was 90s New York in terms of the sort of power grab music culturally. It's like, really, you're gonna like form a garage band in Levi's that's gonna compete with that for attention in terms of how to brand New York City in this era? So it just seemed like the worst possible idea.
We're overdue to play a song, so let's play one from The Strokes, Last Night.
Last night.
Strokes Last Night. We're speaking with Lizzie Goodman. She's the author. I guess you could call her the author more, or the curator. It's all interviews. It's an oral history of a time in New York City. The book is Meet Me in the Bathroom, Rebirth and Rock and Roll in New York City, 2001 to 2011. But Lizzie, you can write. I mean, you are a writer, but your voice is not really coming through here, because it's, to me, your book is like, what I do is editing tape, putting tape together to tell a story. And you have all of these interviews. I had to keep going back to the front of the book to find out, who is this person again? Because a lot of these names I didn't know. It's doable. Is it easier to read on the Kindle?
I've heard that. That is one of the criticisms of the book that exists, which is it's difficult to do the flipping back and forth. I have heard it's easier to do on the Kindle. I know one person tagged me in an Instagram post where they had printed out like their own kind of dossier on the side. So maybe in the next edition, we'll have like a pull out, you know, leaflet or something, so you can hold it in one hand while reading it. I tried to kind of let, when the cast of characters at one point was more, the descriptions were more detailed, and I ended up cutting a lot of them because it matters that you know who you're listening to, and it also doesn't, because the point of oral history, and this is related to your question about, you know, if I'm a writer, why do it this way? I mean, I really wanted to democratize the time. What I love about great oral histories is that, and it's worth pointing out that Please Kill Me, the Legs McNeil, Jillian McCain oral history of New York City punk in the 70s was my inspiration for this. And it's the Bible of that era and the Bible of rock books for a lot of people who are into what I'm into. And this book would not exist without that model. I mean, they were able to kind of ring the bell at the beginning of that book with, and put kind of Lou Reed and Iggy Pop and, you know, Richard Hell next to people you'd never heard of with equal weight and merit. Because again, the point of the story is allegiance to capturing a feeling of a time and place rather than like even a factual rendition of what happened. Like I keep saying that the book is supposed to feel true, not be true.
Okay, let's go to break. We're going to listen to Vampire Weekend. This is Campus. You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio, speaking with Lizzie Goodman, Meet Me in the Bathroom, Rebirth and Rock and Roll in New York City, 2001 to 2011.
I wake up, my shoulder's cold. I've got to leave here. Should learn. Walk out the door, drag my feet along the floor. Then I see you, you're walking across the campus, cool professor studying romances. How am I supposed to pretend?
Song is Heads Will Roll, and it's from the band the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, and the lead singer, the lead individual, the lead power behind that band is Karen O, and she is a force of nature. It seems like every generation has a female iconic rock and roll individual. You can say maybe Chrissy Hines, Lady Gaga, Patti Smith, Debbie Harry. Karen O should probably be in that list. We're talking with Lizzie Goodman. She's the author of the book Meet Me in the Bathroom, Rebirth in Rock and Roll in New York City, 2001 and 2011. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. And Lizzie, talk about Karen O.
Where do I begin with my love for Karen O? I mean, she's on the cover of the book. That's her spitting beer into the sort of iridescent title, if you've seen the cover. She's the lead icon of this era, male or female. She is the top of the mountain in terms of sheer rock star power, charisma, stage presence, radiance, like all the stuff that we think about when we think about great performers. To me, yes, like I think I have been talking quite a bit and talked to her quite a bit for the book and for other pieces that I've written about this idea of being the lone woman, why that is, why more girls don't find themselves in this position, the extent to which it's institutional, which of course it is, and the extent to which it's sort of like broader cultural fear of that you know, discourages women from finding themselves in that position in the first place. I think there's a lot of factors that go into it. But for the purposes of the book, it's like Karen definitely felt like the outsider-ness, the status of that all rock stars seem to feel, this sense of I'm outside the norm, was increased by the fact that she was kind of the only woman around.
Here's another song from the Yeah Yeah Yeahs with Karen O, and this is Maps.
Straight, oh no. Oh, say, 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 wait, they don't love you like I love you. Wait, they don't love you like I love you.
Seems to be an individual who took to being a rock performer, and maybe I did a disservice to her by trying to confine her to all the great women of rock, you know, Janis Joplin and all those folks, but maybe she should stand alongside of gender not included, things like Mick Jagger and Kurt Cobain and others, because she just has that power to her stage persona. And I wonder why the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, although they did hit it big-ish, they were not big, like mega big, and they're still not. They're still out there, but you know, what? Why did they not?
Karen, the Yeah Yeah Yeahs have done it really well because they've never gotten. They do say in the book that a sense of kind of underdogness is key to animating what they do. And none of the bands in this book became that huge. I mean, the Kings of Leon and the Killers did. But the Strokes didn't. I mean, they're really big, but they're not U2. You know, it's not, the scale is less than the Pearl Jam Nirvana era, like in terms of albums sold. And that's partially to do with the changes in the industry we were talking about, but it's partially to do with the fact that somehow Strokes, Yeah Yeah Yeahs, Interpol, I mean, these are bands that are still, they're big and they're weird. That's still true.
Well, the Yeah Yeah Yeahs would classify easily under the weird category. I mean, they're not a typical rock and roll band.
Nick Zinner, who's like, you know, one of the most creative guitar players maybe in history. I mean, and Brian on drums, who's a classically trained drummer, they're just weirdos. They would say that about themselves. It's an odd assembly, and I think that's part of the magic. You know, that identity, that sense of interior weirdness, and commitment to maintaining that, and confidence that when it's done right in the context of what's called the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, it will connect with the people who love them. That's what's made them last.
This is Y Control from the Yeah Yeah Yeahs. Talk about that song. Why is that song worthy of exploration?
All those songs off that first record have in some way in common this tension I've been describing. But Karen's voice is really intense on that record. I mean, on that track, her voice is intense on a lot of tracks. But I think Y Control, you hear that kind of like yearning, screeching. It's somehow both throaty and screeching at the same time. I can just feel her kind of anguish. And then there's the low end of that song. I mean, there's Brian, and then there's Nick, who's just, like I said, it sounds like 10 people are playing guitar, and it's just him. So those are all, that song, I mean, Y Control kind of captures in one track a lot of the sort of bells that they set off, that this band sets off in general in their work. It's representative of a lot of what they're up to.
It seems like Karen O, heavily influenced by David Bowie, a lot of glam rock there.
Yeah, for sure. Oh, yeah. And also just, I mean, the idea of stage presence as in no way distinctive from sound. Like, Karen is also sets herself apart in this era by virtue of her willingness to really go there with costumes. I mean, her collaboration, this is a big theme in the book, her collaboration with Christian Joy, her costume designer and best friend, is huge. It's huge for the Yeah Yeah Yeahs sound, and it's huge for the Yeah Yeah Yeahs, for Karen's sense of how to unburden herself on stage in order to become the person she needs to be to lead that band and to make those sounds.
What's a good song to play here?
A Bowie song.
Fame?
Yeah, play Fame, yeah.
All right, David Bowie, Fame.
Fame makes a man take things.
talked about fashion. New York City, right at this era, also the fashion world was catching on fire. There was a crossover between this music scene and fashionistas.
Yeah, the fashion always comes around, but when something starts to get cool, I think New York City became cool again in the wake of the Strokes and all these other bands we're talking about rise. So in 2000, like, nobody wanted to kind of to co-opt New York City as a as an idea in any other cultural form or realm. But then by 2002, 2003, it was like all of a sudden that was the cool place to be. So inherently, you're going to get real estate development and filmmakers coming in to tell stories about this. And, you know, fashion people wanting to throw parties in which all these bands are the featured guests or whatever. And to some extent, for sure, fashion being influenced by how these people dressed. I mean, I remember going to the Target in Albuquerque, New Mexico, and on some break from, you know, being in New York, maybe Christmas or something, and seeing, you know, mock vintage t-shirts and pleather motorcycle jackets at Target. And I was just like, I think, is it possible that this is coming from everything that I'm witnessing in this? I mean, it seems that these were not here before.
We're going to go to break, play another cut from the Ya Ya Ya's. This is Sacrilege, released in 2013. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio, talking about Meet Me in the Bathroom, Rebirth and Rock and Roll in New York City, 2001 to 2011. Stay tuned. Who's Got the Crack by Moldy Peaches. It is a band that is featured in the book, talked about in the book, Meet Me in the Bathroom, Rebirth and Rock and Roll in New York City, 2001 to 2011. We're speaking with the author, Lizzie Goodman, and she was there. She witnessed it. She experienced it. She wrote about it. And now she is sort of putting out the Bible of what happened during that era, an oral history of this iconic time during in New York City.
The reason they're relevant, I mean, they're so weird and awesome. They dressed up in animal costumes on stage and played this kind of deliberately childlike, profane rock and roll. And then the Strokes were considered super cool, and everyone thought they were such sort of like badasses, and they were, but the Moldy Peaches were their favorite band. So, and they took them on tour all the time and basically, like, you know, launched them. And I think that's important for the bigger story I'm telling, because it's important to remember that, like, they're those guys, these like holier than thou cool rock stars, were kind of outsider dorks. Like, not dorks like couldn't get girls, certainly not the Strokes, but dorks like not part of the mainstream, didn't identify as part of the kind of like jock class in the high school. It was like they were friends with the freaks, and that's who they liked.
I guess you could call them counter cool.
Yeah. Yes, that's right. And it's hard. It's, you know, they were just like good looking.
I know we started off by saying that the Strokes started it all, but actually before the Strokes, there was Jonathan Fire Eater, and people in your book, in as you talk to them, in oral history, they refer to them as what sort of the proto band that was launching this new era of rock?
Totally. I mean, there's a great line in the book. I think it's Jenny, again, LSU, who says that by the time the Stork showed up, Jonathan Fireeater taught people in the industry and New York City essentially how to hate them. Because Jonathan Fireeater were this group of dark, brooding, super talented, really good-looking, kind of sharp-dressed private school kids from D.C. in this case, but they were signed to a $1 million record deal by DreamWorks in the mid-90s out of New York, and everyone thought, or some people thought, that they were going to save rock and roll and that they would launch a global revolution of rock cool, and they were the band to do it, and they totally imploded. They were amazing, and then they kind of imploded in this haze of drug abuse and infighting and the usual, and so out of the ashes formed the Walkmen. So we got the Walkmen, which is, I mean, they're just amazing. So that was, we're happy to have them. But Jonathan Fireeater were the cautionary tale. So that's another reason that just piled on fuel to the fire of the idea that, like, yeah, right, you're gonna do anything being a rock band in New York City in 1998. Like, did you not just hear what happened to Jonathan Fireeater? So it's fun to be able to celebrate their music now because it's so good. But man, I mean, they crash and burn so good.
This is When the Curtain Calls for You, Jonathan Fireeater. Another band that LCD Sound System. What is their story?
The James Murphy story is really what's covered here. The origin of DFA Records and of James Murphy as a persona in the music space is what's covered. LCD forms kind of out of a series of events that we cover in detail that happened to James and his record label. And I think what LCD is about and what James is about, and also the band that was signed to DFA and that kind of the story gets told contemporaneously with the formation of DFA, is The Rapture. They were about and remain about making rock music danceable and making dance music bloody and sweaty and sexy. You know, this sense of like putting bodies back in the dance realm and putting danceability back in the rock realm, the hybrid of those two things.
That punk is playing at my house, my house. I'll show you the ropes, kid, show you the ropes. Got a bus and a trailer at my house, my house. I'll show you the ropes, kid, show you the ropes. I bought 15 cases for my house, my house. All the furniture is in the garage. Well, that bug is playing in my house, my house. You got to set them up, kid. Set them up.
listening to this music and trying to draw connections of some of these dots, and the dots keep fading and exploding, and it's hard to do that. But you're seeing, you know, the bands, they're not writing about typically romanticized, sexualized love, but they're writing about, it seems like there's a theme of, we live in a messed up world and we got to figure out how I'm going to make sense of it. I mean, that's seems to be the theme.
There's a great title to a TV on the radio song, I Was a Lover Before This War. I think I have that exactly right. And TV on the Radio, Dave Siddick, who is one of the founding members of TV on the Radio and also produced the first CIAS record. And I mean, there's a sense of foreboding that they talk about, that, and that it's for sure connected to 9/11 and gentrification and the kind of the financial washing over of New York City and the commodification of Brooklyn that took place during this period of time, all of which is covered in the book extensively. But yeah, I mean, you're talking about a group of people who are, Dave also says about TV on the Radio, it's like a book club. You know, these are like literate kind of nerds sitting in a bus touring the country reading Naomi Klein. You know, that was their vibe. They're not the cool kids.
Was this a golden age?
It was this a golden age. Listen, I spent six years of my life writing a book about this period of time in music, so I believe that it was a cultural golden age, the effects of which we're still seeing playing out. I mean, the fact that you can go to any kiosk in any European city and buy an I Heart Brooklyn t-shirt is a result of James Murphy, of TV on the Radio, of Karen. Like, that's the shifting notion of New York cool is what's documented here. I also happen to believe it's a golden age of music, but I don't think those two things are necessarily the same thing. So yes, if you ask me, but I think there's nuance to what that means.
We're going to go out listening to the song Golden Age from TV on the Radio. We've been speaking with Lizzie Goodman. Her book is Meet Me in the Bathroom, Rebirth and Rock and Roll in New York City, 2001 to 2011. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio.
Can't stop what's coming up, you're never gonna stop, gonna live it up and-